Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to the Animation Podcast, a weekly podcast about all things animation brought to you by Filmbook. My name is Matt Brunet, but some of you may know me as Animat from my YouTube channel, Electric Dragon 505, home of web series that are all about animation, including Animation Look Back and Animat's Reviews. If this is your first time here in the Animation Podcast, well, the title will go and explain everything for you. This is a podcast that talks about animation. Get it? Okay, good. That's beautiful. Now, but specifically, though, it talked about the latest news that happened this week. So on today's episode, I'm going to start things off by looking into who got nominated at the Golden Globes. Then afterwards, we will be looking at not one, but two big trailers of two big animated features coming out in 2017. Then we will be looking into the most unlikely pairing that you would imagine. Then afterwards, we will be officially looking into the spiritual successor of Studio Ghibli. Then finally, we got Matt's Pick of the Week. If you want to check out more episodes of the Animation Podcast, then head on down to Filmbook, that is film-book.com, by searching the Animation Podcast. You can also email us at podcast@filmbook.com with the Animation Podcast in the subject line. And so, first things first, I'm going to be talking to you guys about the Golden Globes, or as I would like to call it, the appetizers to the Oscars, or a little bit of a clue of what could get nominated at the Oscars, basically. Now, what is actually interesting about the Golden Globes is that so far, everybody's mostly paying attention to who's pretty much getting the most nominations so far. Like, a lot of people are talking about La La Land, a lot of people are talking about Moonlight, and of course, a lot of people are talking about The People versus O.J. Simpson in the TV categories. However, this time we are only going to be looking into the categories that feature animated films. And surprisingly, it's not just one this time. There are actually two in which animation is actually pretty much dominating. And of course, the first one being Best Animated Feature. And so, the ones that the Golden Globes actually nominated are Kubo and the Two Strings, Moana, My Life as a Zucchini, Sing, and Zootopia. But that is not all. There is also another category in which animation is pretty much taking over, and believe it or not, is actually with Best Original Song. Now, it's not completely covered with animated features. There are a few of them where there are some live-action films in there, but the majority, believe it or not, is actually with animated films. So the nominees in here include Can't Stop the Feeling from Trolls, City of Stars from La La Land, Faith from Sing, Gold from Gold, and How Far I'll Go from Moana. So that's basically the whole thing with all the animated films. And from what I'm seeing so far, it's actually a very interesting choice that we have over here. For one, Finding Dory actually didn't make it, which, considering the big praise that it got and also the big financial success that it earned, I'm surprised that it actually did get overlooked, even at the Golden Globes. But probably the biggest thing that really did stand out for me is actually the selection of My Life as a Zucchini. And I actually double-checked, in its entire history over here in the Golden Globes, there was only one time ever that they actually listed an independent animated feature to be nominated at the Golden Globes for Best Animated Feature. And that one is The Illusionist by Sylvain Chomet. And literally that's it. Every single other one is pretty much a mainstream animated feature, you know, like ones that cost like millions and millions of dollars and are distributed by big companies. They pretty much got released from there. I mean, like, technically you can also put in like Fantastic Mr. Fox and Anomalisa to the list of independent, because it wasn't until a little bit later that they would get picked up by a big company like Paramount or Fox. But the big thing is that this one right here with My Life as a Zucchini, this is full-on an independent animated feature, so it is a pretty rare moment. And what it does say to me is that now there's a very high chance that we are going to see My Life as a Zucchini probably get nominated at the Oscars. Like I previously said in one of the previous animation podcasts, we know for a fact that Zootopia is going to be in it as your placeholder for a Disney film. And we know that Kubo and the Two Strings is going to be there as your placeholder for a stop-motion film. So maybe we're going to see My Life as a Zucchini in there as the placeholder for independent animated features. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that what is reflected on the... What is pretty much reflected in the Golden Globes doesn't necessarily reflect upon what's going to be nominated at the Oscars. There's still going to be other stuff nominated, and there is a very high chance that we'll see two independent animated features get nominated. And the last time, I heavily implied that we're going to see The Red Turtle get a nomination in there alongside My Life as a Zucchini, which pretty much leaves us with one other nomination. And it's actually a very surprising choice that they would also include Sing into this. As I'm recording it, keep in mind, I have yet to see Sing. The movie is just right around the corner when it's going to be released in theaters, so eventually I'll see for myself what's all the hubbub with Sing. So maybe it's going to be fantastic, maybe not, who knows, we'll just have to see. But right now it just leaves us with one more spot, if it is the case that they're not going to include The Red Turtle. So right now it seems like it's going to be a battle between either Sing or Moana. And in this case, I don't know if they'll even include Finding Dory at this point, so maybe we'll have to cross that off. But yeah, this is actually quite an interesting choice, but overall I would say that I definitely do applaud to the Hollywood Foreign Press to actually do include that they would actually do include an independent animated feature, because like I said before, like, for the longest time, all they've been doing is just listing mainstream animated features, down to the point that, like, if you've been released worldwide by a big-name studio, it's actually not that hard to actually get a nomination at the Golden Globes. Because keep in mind, like, there are legit movies like Hotel Transylvania, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, and even both Cars movies. Cars and Cars 2 actually got a nomination. And the first Cars is actually the first ever animated feature to win the category of Best Animated Feature. It actually, like, this is a new product. And it's going to be, like, the 10th anniversary of the Golden Globes having Best Animated Feature. So Cars is going to be the first, like, Cars was actually the first one ever to win that. Oh, and also, I just want to add in, also, guess what actually did get a Golden Globe nomination for Best Animated Feature? Yeah, believe it or not, B-Movie. Yeah, B-Movie somehow even got a nomination. With all the crazy memes that you've been seeing, like, I guess we can also add that one in to be nominated for the Golden Globes. But yeah, my whole point that I'm pretty much trying to say is that, like, it's not necessarily hard for a mainstream animated film to get nominated at the Golden Globes. But, yeah, like, I'm glad I can see My Life as a Zucchini actually break the mold, and hopefully we'll see more of these animated features, well, independent animated features, to see if they can break the mold in that category right there. Okay, so that's my entire fill on the Best Animated Feature category at the Golden Globes. Let's take a moment now to reflect upon Best Original Song to see if that is going to, like, how is this going to reflect upon what we are about to see at the Oscars when they're going to announce those categories and all that kind of stuff. So, from what I'm gathering, it could be highly possible that we will see a good chunk of animated films. Now, I can guarantee you that we will actually see animated film, like, at least one animated film get nominated at the Oscars so far. Like, rather it be Moana with How Far I'll Go, or with Trolls with Can't Stop the Feeling. I'm not expecting that the majority at the Oscars for Best Original Song will be covered with animated films. Like, the one so far that I'm not 100% sure could get a nomination is Faith from Sing. I'm not too sure with that. This is one of the first times that I'm seeing it pop up in that category in terms of all the different early award shows so far. Like, I've seen Can't Stop the Feeling and How Far I'll Go pop up several times, but not necessarily Faith. So I'm not 100% sure if I'll see it actually pop up in the nominations right there. But honestly, I feel like the real competitor in terms of that category is not necessarily going to be the animated films, but it's going to be City of Stars, because La La Land is the big movie so far. I mean, according to what we've been getting with early award shows, La La Land seems to be the big Oscar buzz or like award buzz movie. The one that so far has been gathering a lot of awards, it's been gathering a lot of attention, so who knows? Maybe we'll actually see that movie get that award. Now, personally, I feel like I want to see How Far I'll Go actually get that win. It's such a fantastic song, but chances are, like, I feel like the big competitor so far is going to be How Far I'll Go or City of Stars. But yeah, so overall, that's going to be our whole overview of what animation took over at the Golden Globes. And we'll just have to wait and see who is going to win when it will be announced. When the Golden Globes are going to be announced on January 8th. All right, the next thing that I have for you guys is going to be two trailers, specifically two of which that are going to be about some major animated features coming out in 2017. One from DreamWorks Animation and another from Illumination. And the result that came out of it is actually rather interesting. And before I get into both of them at the same time, allow me to go into them individually, and I'll start things off with the one from DreamWorks, which is The Boss Baby. And honestly, I have been waiting for this trailer for a while now, because the thing is, if you guys remember back the first time I talked about The Boss Baby and the trailer that it released, I was immensely unimpressed. Like, honestly, for me, that trailer tells me that the biggest selling point is apparently Alec Baldwin is a baby. And literally, that's it. I mean, there isn't necessarily even a point to why this would be an animated feature. And this feels like it would be more in the veins of something like Nine Lives, where the cheap marketing ploy would be that, oh, where Kevin Spacey is a cat, Alec Baldwin is being his Alec Baldwin self, like how he is in 30 Rock or SNL when he's impersonating Donald Trump. But this time, he is a baby. And literally, that's it. So I wanted to give this movie the benefit of a doubt, and I feel like there should be at least more to what we got in that trailer. And what we have, well, I'll give it this. They did deliver a lot more than they did in the previous trailer. What is actually interesting to note is that last time, in the first trailer, it looked like the main character would be the kid of the family, where apparently it's going to be more about his story and his perspective when the Alec Baldwin came into the scene and all that kind of stuff, and where we pretty much end off at the peak where he discovers that apparently the baby can talk and he has this whole corporation and stuff like that. But in here, it looks like it's going to be more the Alec Baldwin baby that's going to be the star of this movie, from the beginning to the end. Because here's the story that we got from this trailer. Now, apparently, the Alec Baldwin baby runs this big corporation that's, well, run by babies. And so far, his company is actually really collapsing. Because in terms of the cuteness factor, people are focusing a lot less on babies and a lot more on puppies. And with that, I guess what's going on is that babies are becoming more like actual babies. And with that, the Alec Baldwin baby ends up being adopted into a real home where apparently, like, that's where we get the scenarios from the first trailer. But the relationship between the kid and the baby is now a lot more revealed, where now the kid has to work with the Alec Baldwin baby in order to go and save his corporation from being destroyed by puppies. And we also get introduced to many of the other characters as well, which specifically we see more of the Alec Baldwin baby's staff. Like, we see, like, his secretary who doesn't know how to read. We got this big baby called Jimbo, and we got some triplets as well. And that's mostly his staff in which he talks to. And even though, yes, this trailer is showing a lot more substance into what this movie could potentially deliver, honestly, this is not impressing me. Like, I'm still rather unamused by what this movie could potentially turn out to be. It's not going to be the worst animated film. I don't even think this could even be one of the worst DreamWorks films, but it'll definitely be one of the weaker ones, for sure. Because honestly, like, the humor that it's trying to deliver, like, honestly, it's not really effective for me. I don't know about you guys, but I feel like so far with this trailer, they're trying to emphasize on the baby factor. And really, it's all about, like, mixing humor with cute babies. That's pretty much the whole goal with the Boss Baby. And honestly, I don't know if I can really get down to it. Like, there was only one time in this whole trailer that did actually make me chuckle, or it actually legitimately made me laugh. It was when, oh, excuse me about that, folks. But anyways, as I was saying, the only time that did make me laugh was when the Alec Baldwin baby, apparently he has to go undercover and he disguises himself as a puppy. And he goes into it going, it's like, oh god, this is so humiliating. And then you see another dog that's just sniffing the Alec Baldwin baby's butt. And just his reaction actually did make me laugh. But other than that, the humor is not really that effective for me. I don't know if it's really going to be a knockout selling point for this film. But at the same time, another thing that really did turn me off is actually the story. And I feel like in this, it is way too freaking predictable, especially with the relationship between the kid and the Alec Baldwin baby. Because you can definitely tell what's going to be happening. At first, the kid and the Alec Baldwin baby, they're not going well. Their relationship is not all that great. But then apparently, like, with this whole partnership that they have to do in order to save Alec Baldwin baby's corporation, they gotta go work together and make it seem like, oh, they're getting along and stuff like that. Which, I think we all know that at the end, the outcome will be that, oh, they can get along together. And maybe the Alec Baldwin baby won't be going away. He's gonna stay with the family. Like, you could definitely tell that's the outcome of this movie, hands down. I mean, I feel like this is just predictable. And I don't know. So far, I'm not really sold into that. I mean, the only thing that could save it is going to be the relationship, well, not the relationship, but I mean more the character, the actual characters of the kid himself and the Alec Baldwin baby. If they can actually manage to deliver really likable characters, then maybe this relationship could actually work, regardless if the plot is a little too obvious or not. But other than that, like, I really don't feel like there's a bonding, well, not a bonding, but I don't really feel like there's a connection. I'm not 100% sure if the kid or the Alec Baldwin baby will actually be likable characters. It's just, I don't know, like, I feel like it wants to have, like, this is the kind of film that really wants to have a lot of heart, but I'm not sure if I'm fully sold into that. So, honestly, I don't know. This is not really turning me on so far. Okay, well, I don't really mean about like that, but what I mean is that I'm not necessarily sure if I'm sold to this idea. Like, maybe it has a lot more secrets that we don't know. Like, the one thing that I do hope that they can look upon a lot more is that is if the movie would be focusing more regarding the Boss Baby's corporation. If they can open up a lot more to that world, then maybe it can deliver something that's a lot more promising. But other than that, I don't really see much onto how this is going to be fantastic. I don't really see how this is really that big of a deal of a DreamWorks movie. It's just, I don't know. I'm not completely sold on this. So who knows how this could actually turn out. But then we have the other trailer. And I just want to start off by saying that so far, when it comes to the animated films, it looks like a bunch of mucus has been building up onto my throat. I'm sorry about that. But anyways, as I was saying, that so far, when it comes to the animated films of 2017, there really isn't much that I am fully sold onto. Like, so far, there isn't an animated film in which I really am anticipated for or that I'm really excited for, to be very honest. I mean, sure, I can guess that a lot of people are probably excited for the Lego Batman movie, but even at that, like, yeah, sure, it looks fun, it looks enjoyable, and there's a good chance it could be good, but it looks like we're pretty much going to get the same thing with the Lego movie, but as a Batman parody. You know, that like that's all we're going to get. But so far, there is actually one that I am now legitimately excited for. Like, this trailer came up, and honestly, I was worried if this is going to be the one that could break the franchise or, like, kill it off. But now I'm actually pretty confident that this could actually turn out to be a fantastic film. And honestly, I'm really excited for it. And I'm talking, of course, about the first trailer of Despicable Me 3. Now, so far, in terms of the story, we don't really have a lot in this. We don't really know what's going to be going on in terms of the story. Like, they didn't really disclose that. The big thing that this commercial advertised was on the new villain and the action, I would say. That's mostly the two big things that they delivered, is the new villain and the action that we got. And my God, with this new villain that they got, Balthazar Brat, he is amazing. He is absolutely hilarious. If you guys don't know who he is played by Trey Parker, one of the co-creators of South Park. And he's best described as a full-on 80s supervillain. Like, he is entirely themed of 80s. He has this ugly-looking mullet. He's dressed entirely like Michael Jackson, on top of copying his moves. And also, like, his weaponry is entirely themed of 80s, where he always has bubble gum, in which, like, it can completely expand. He also has an exploding Rubik's Cube. And, like, his weapon that he would hold on his hand would actually be a keytar. And oh my God, just by seeing this trailer, I kid you not, this is the kind of character that I can assure you guys that no matter who worked on this guy, rather it be Trey Parker on the voice, rather it be the directors, rather it be whichever animator who worked on him, like, they must have had such a total blast. Like, this guy is just absolutely fun to watch. He's just so hilarious, and oh my God, like, this is just, he's just fantastic to look at, and just to see his weaponry as a villain. Like, we have yet to see, like, his background story, we have yet to see, like, the character himself, how he's going to be in general, but so far, I am really loving this villain. He just seems, like, conceptually and execution-wise, he just seems absolutely fantastic and absolutely hilarious. But at the same time, you also got the humor and the action, which that's actually another thing I forgot that this movie delivered. It's actually on the humor as well. But in terms of the action, you do get a lot more of, like, more of what Balthazar Brat can do when he goes around trying to steal this diamond on a ship, and suddenly with his bubblegum, he actually makes the ship flying, surprisingly enough. But then we also see like Gru and Lucy trying to go out and stop him. Like we see a bit more of their weaponry and like all the different ways to see how they fight against villains and stuff like that. But then my favorite part, and honestly, I have never laughed at a joke from a trailer in so long, but this is one of the funniest things that I've seen. Oh my god, it is so amazing. It is when Gru, like, he was facing Balthazar, and then suddenly, like, he uses his keytar to create, like, giant sound waves to blow off Gru from the ship. But what ended up happening, it just blew off all of his clothes, and Gru, like, suddenly flew off, but he managed to land on some bubblegum, and then, like, now he's just dangling from the ship, like, only wearing nothing but, like, that bubblegum. And then, like, he passes through this building where apparently they're throwing this birthday party, and all Gru could do is just join in, and he's just there, like, in the middle going, "Happy birthday, dear Dan! Happy birthday to you!" Oh my god, it is so hilarious. I loved it. It is so freaking funny, I swear to god. Oh yeah. Oh, but there is actually another thing that, speaking of that part, what is actually surprising to note is that the minions only appeared right at the end, after that great joke appeared. So the minions are just there, and then suddenly, they would throw this major big, like, DJ party, and that's it. Which is actually very interesting, because if you remember in the trailers of Despicable Me 2, the minions were heavily advertised. Like, you could tell that the minions played a key factor onto the whole Despicable Me 2 movie. But that is actually more into the marketing. It's actually quite debatable if, in Despicable Me 2, if the minions really did have this major role or not. But I know that they played a key part, at least into the marketing. But it's surprising that in here, that they don't have that big of a role. They just only appeared in the end because it is a Despicable Me movie. And you cannot make a Despicable Me movie without having the minions. Maybe we did get a massive overdose with the minions movie back in 2015. But what we got in here, like, maybe they will tone down the minions, which I think a lot of people will be relieved with. But yeah, overall, I would definitely say that I am absolutely excited for the Despicable Me movie. The Despicable Me 3 movie. This trailer absolutely sold it for me. And yeah, and if we do have to compare the two, hands down, I'm a lot more excited for Despicable Me 3. In fact, honestly, that would actually make an interesting debate, because honestly, I've been thinking about this for a while, because the thing is, with the Boss Baby, it's not going to be alone, because technically, like, when the Boss Baby will be released, the week after, it's actually going to be Sony's Smurfs The Lost Village. So we might actually have this giant clash between two animated features. Who knows which one is going to be the best so far, but I think, honestly, even for me, I would say that I'm probably more sold on the Smurfs, because I know that that one will actually sell me on something that could be more visually pleasing than on the Boss Baby. Oh my god, what the fridge am I talking about? Me apparently, like, I just realized, wait a minute. Oh, sorry about that. I just noticed that, wait a minute. I'm saying that apparently a Sony movie might deliver on something that's more visually pleasing than a DreamWorks movie. What the fridge is going on? No, but actually, let me know what you think, guys. Like, in terms of those two movies, which ones do you think are more... Well, which one do you think you're more anticipated for? Are you more excited for The Boss Baby or Smurfs The Lost Village when it's going to be coming out? Like, when those two films will be in theaters, and if you only had one choice to pick, which one are you going to go see? But at the same time, I also want to ask you guys, which one are you excited for? Which one do you think is actually the better trailer that we got? Despicable Me 3 or The Boss Baby? I'll let you guys decide, but for me, hands down, the big winner is going to be Despicable Me 3. But if you want to know which one, which of these movies are going to be released, well, The Boss Baby is going to be coming out first on March 31st, while Despicable Me 3 is going to be coming out somewhere in the beginning or in the middle of, where was it? The middle of, somewhere in the summer of 2017. Okay, so for our next story, this is going to be the collaboration of two entities I never expected would actually work together. Because you got one side that so far in 2016 has gathered such a huge reputation, and like you see them, like, or at least one of them, just have this massive rise of fame, and then you got another which doesn't have that good of a reputation. In fact, like, you could definitely tell that things are definitely going downhill with them. And I am actually talking about the people that made Hamilton and Sony Pictures Animation. What the fridge do these two have in common? I have no idea, but apparently there is one. And it's about an animated project called Vivo. Now, you might be wondering, what is this project called Vivo? Well, believe it or not, it actually has a very fascinating story. It has a fascinating history, actually. Because the thing is, Vivo started out as a project done in DreamWorks Animation. Like, at the very beginning, they were setting all this up, and Lin-Manuel Miranda has already written a lot of the songs for it. But then, suddenly, as you guys know, things really went downhill for DreamWorks, and things ended up going badly, where they had to lay off a lot of employees, they had to shut down the Redwood division, and they pretty much had to reschedule everything and cut off a lot of projects. And unfortunately, this was one of them. Now, what ended up happening afterwards, apparently, was that the project ended up being moved to Sony Pictures Animation, considering that the head of Sony right now, Christine Belson, she used to work at DreamWorks beforehand, so she's pretty much recycling her old material. And so far what they have gathered with the story, going into my source here in Variety, it says the film follows a monkey who loves music and adventure, leading him to make a dangerous journey from Havana to Miami to fulfill his destiny. And believe it or not, we actually do have some people in charge of this project. We got some big people. So yes, Lin-Manuel Miranda is working on the music. But then we also got the book writer of Hamilton, Kiera Kiera Alegría Hudez. She's going to be the writer of this film. And believe it or not, they already got a director, which in this case, they actually got Kirk D'Amico. He is at... By the way, I do apologize, guys, if I keep on coughing. I just went through a cold, and I'm pretty much at the tail end of the sickness, so I'm trying to get back on the saddle, so I do apologize. But anyways, Kirk D'Amico, you guys might actually remember as the director of The Croods, or at least the co-director with Chris Sanders. But now that The Croods 2 is pretty much canceled, he doesn't have a job so far, so he might as well move to Sony and work on Vivo. And so far, that's pretty much what we got with this whole project. Oh, and by the way, they actually did set up for a release date. They actually did place everything so that the movie would be released at the end of 2020. So with all that said, believe it or not, guys, I'm actually pretty excited for it. I mean, like, with what Lin-Manuel Miranda and his crew actually delivered with both Hamilton and his collaboration in Moana, that's actually amazing. I'm actually pretty excited to see what he has with Vivo. I mean, like I said, if things worked out really well with something like Moana, then I'm sure he can do something great with Vivo. He's, like, Lin-Manuel is no stranger to animation, and especially that he's bringing help from his crew from Hamilton, like Hudez. You know, it's gonna be hard for anybody to really screw up. Honestly, I can't even imagine Sony Animation to take something like Vivo and turn it into something like a piece of crap, you know? Like that, like honestly, this actually might turn out to be pretty good. I'm actually pretty excited for this. So who knows how this might actually turn out. And, you know, with the way that they got everything set up, they already got a writer, they already got the music for it, which apparently it already exists, like, and it's already years old, and they already got a director for it. You know, I actually do have confidence that they might actually know what they're doing. They might actually know where to go with it. So who knows? This might actually turn out great. But there is actually one major concern that I do have with this Vivo project, and that is actually regarding with Sony Pictures Animation. Now, I know that a lot of people might think that, oh, this is anime talking, and he hates Sony Pictures Animation. Like, I understand that a lot of people might first think of that, but that's actually not what I'm referring to when my concerns is about Sony. It's not necessarily, it's like what I said before, you know? I just stated that I don't think even Sony Animation would actually screw up something like Vivo, you know? I actually have confidence in this project. But what does bring me concern is the fact, do we even know if Sony Pictures Animation is gonna last until 2020? Because keep in mind, things are really going downhill for Sony Pictures Animation. They're really not doing well as a company. And in 2017, they're really going to try to, like, rebrand the entire, like, the entire company of Sony Animation, and they're pretty much putting all their cards onto 2017. Like, not only are they releasing three animated features, and eventually they're going to do a lot more with, they're going to release 2 to 3 animated features annually. But at the same time, they're also releasing a straight-to-DVD animated film and two TV shows based on their movies. So pretty much they're laying everything out in 2017, and who knows? Like, if things don't work out there, then maybe they might not even have a future. Maybe, like if things really screw up in 2017, then 2018 could be, like, their final year, and any other projects that would be coming up afterwards, it would pretty much be over. That's my biggest concern. And so far, with the stuff that they've released in 2017, the grand majority of them don't hold promise. I mean, you've already got Surf's Up 2, which is already a joke in itself. But, like, when you look into the TV shows that they have, like, so far from what I'm hearing, there's not a lot, like, there really isn't a lot of people who have promise, rather it be the Cloudy series or the Hotel Transylvania series. And really, the only one that I can see that can actually make a profit is actually Smurfs. And even at that, I imagine, like, the most that it can make would be in the same numbers as the Angry Birds movie. But then, at the same time, they also have the Emoji movie, which is already giving Sony Animation a complete bad name, and chances are it's going to come out as a box office bomb. And then you also got The Star, in which that one is actually, like, it could turn out fantastic, but the thing is with The Star is that it's really limiting to its audience. I mean, this is not just a Christmas movie, but it's also a Christian Christmas movie, since this is about the baby Jesus and stuff like that. And plus the fact, like, and, you know, the weird thing is that they did actually move the release date from December to somewhere like in the first half of November, which honestly makes no sense because now they're putting the release date a lot closer to Halloween more than on Christmas. And even before, releasing it before Thanksgiving, like, honestly, it's really dangerous. And that's just calling for it to be a box office bomb. Like, I cannot imagine a lot of people are going to watch it, especially if just a few weeks after that, it's going to be a big Pixar movie like Coco. So chances are, I'm just worried that Sony is going to die before they can actually have a chance to go and release Vivo, which then afterwards, I guess Lin-Manuel has to take Vivo and give it to another company. Rather it be like, maybe it could be Disney, maybe it could be Blue Sky, maybe it could be Paramount, who knows? But yeah, that's overall my biggest concern is that, okay, I'm happy and it's fantastic that Sony would actually make a project like Vivo, but are they even going to last that long? Who knows? Maybe they will, and maybe we will actually see Vivo at the end of 2020. But with the way that the company is right now, yeah, it's not showing me a lot of confidence, so I don't know, who knows. But if it does happen that they do somehow survive, then we'll just have to wait and see how Vivo will be when it will come out on December 18th, 2020. Now for our next story, we actually have another trailer. Now, I didn't necessarily include it with the other ones, like with The Boss Baby and Despicable Me 3, because it's more of its own thing. But oh my god, this is actually fantastic. Like, honestly, I was blown away by this movie, just by the quality alone of it. And I am talking, of course, about a movie called Mary and the Witch's Flower, which is actually based on the Mary Stuart book, The Little Broomstick. Now, we don't know specifically of what the movie itself will be, but Anime News Network actually did provide with the description of what the Little Broomstick book is actually about. Now, apparently it says here, it is Tib the Black Cat who leads Mary to the strange flower in the woods. When she discovers a little broomstick shortly afterwards, she is astonished to feel it jump into action. Before she can gather her wits, it is whisking her over the treetops, above the clouds, and into the grounds of Endor College, where all examinations coached for by a competent staff of fully qualified witches. Here, she discovers evidence of a terrible experiment in transformation, deformed and mutant animals imprisoned in cages. In the moment after her broomstick takes off, she realizes that Tib has been captured. Returning to the college the following day, she manages to free the animals, but not before the head of college, Mr. Mumblechook, and her colleagues, Dr. D, have seen her. Mary manages to flee, but the evil plans are in hot pursuit. Now, it's not necessarily the plot itself that blew me away. It's the fact that, oh my god, this is the best way to describe it is, I can't believe it's not Studio Ghibli. Because you show it to anyone and they would swear that this is legit a Studio Ghibli film. It has the exact same style, it has the exact same look to it, it has the same quality, the exact same creativity of it. Like, everything feels like it's from Studio Ghibli. But it's not really Studio Ghibli. It's from people who worked at Studio Ghibli. Now, apparently, Mary and the Witch's Flower is from a studio called Studio Ponoc, and it's actually founded by Studio Ghibli producer Yoshiaki Nishimura. And the majority of the staff is actually from people who used to work at Studio Ghibli. And even the big heads who are working on this movie are actually from people who have a well-respected reputation at Studio Ghibli. The director is actually Hiromasa Yonebayashi, who you may know as the director of The Secret World of Arrietty and When Marnie Was There. The writer is Riko Sakaguchi, who actually wrote Isao Takahata's The Tale of the Princess Kaguya. And the composer is Takatsuku Muramatsu, who previously did the music of When Marnie Was There. And also we have a co-director and animation supervisor for this film is Yoshiyuki Momose, who was the key animator of such films as Porco Rosso, Spirited Away, and Tales from Earthsea. And so far, that's the whole picture of Studio Ponoc. The big goal for them is to be the spiritual successor of Studio Ghibli. So if ever comes the case that Studio Ghibli does close down and Hayao Miyazaki is officially retired from his work and also from life and all that kind of stuff, we are confident that the spirit of Studio Ghibli will forever be alive in Studio Ponoc. And that's exactly what we get in here. I looked at the trailer of this, which interestingly enough, they provided both an English and a Japanese trailer for it. And honestly, it's really fascinating. It is so amazing. Oh my God. You guys seriously have to see this because it's totally is Studio Ghibli-esque. And I mean, you actually do get this scene where like you got a bunch of divers and suddenly like all their heads, their arms and their legs, they actually pop out and they become fishes and stuff like that. And it's very reminiscent to Ponyo. And then you actually do get a scene where Mary is on a broomstick and she's flying, which is very reminiscent to Kiki's Delivery Service. And oh my God, like, honestly, and then you got the background, like, you actually got the beautifully painted backgrounds where you got a lot of luscious greens. And that one actually kind of reminds me of, like, the backgrounds with what you got in The Secret World of Arrietty. Like, this is legit the spiritual successor of Studio G. It's so much like Studio Ghibli, it's blowing me away. But this is not Studio Ghibli. This is from people who worked at Studio Ghibli. And honestly, this is really getting me excited that this is a sign that the spirit of Studio Ghibli will live on forever. Like, even if it's without the Studio Ghibli name. Like, we got people who were born and raised working on the craftsmanship of what Studio Ghibli offered, and now they can express it in other different studios and other different works, where technically, like, I'm not saying that we no longer need Studio Ghibli. It would be fantastic if they could still stick around. But now we know that the spirit of Studio Ghibli can forever live on. And we can have more of that style of features. You know, it can continuously be released. And this is freaking amazing what we got with Mary and the Witch's Flower. Oh my God! It is so fantastic! And if you're like me, if you're excited for this movie to actually go out and be released, so far they didn't put a specific release date, but so far in Japan, they did announce that it's going to be out in 2017, and there could be a chance that maybe we'll actually get it in English as well, that it will be released somewhere late in 2017. And so finally, we now have Matt's Pick of the Week. And for this week, this is something that happens annually. This is no big deal, really. This is an animation roundtable, where big film journalist websites like Variety, Deadline, and all those websites, they would go and bring in animation directors, and they would go and have this roundtable discussing about their experience about working with the feature film that has been released on that year. And this year, specifically with The Hollywood Reporter, they decided to go and bring in some of these directors, including Byron Howard, which for a long time I kept on saying Brian Howard for some reason. Byron, I am so sorry for that mistake. So they got Byron Howard of Zootopia, Garth Jennings of Sing, Travis Knight of Kubo and the Two Strings, Mike Mitchell of Trolls, Seth Rogen, technically he is not a director, but he is a writer and the star and also a producer of the movie Sausage Party, John Musker of Moana, and also Mark Osborne of The Little Prince. So, okay, things are going well. They had their little chat and stuff like that, and The Hollywood Reporter decided to release it on their website. But somehow, holy crap, the response that they got from it, it left people pissed. Now, the thing is that this year's roundtable actually made a lot of people mad. Now, what is it specifically that, you know, that this animation roundtable would actually go and make people livid, that it would blow their top? Would it be that one of the directors said something terrible, that they said something racist, that they said something sexist, that they said something very mean-spirited? Well, no, it's not that. You know, did one of the animation directors, like, touch each other's dicks or something? Or did they get naked? No, not really. It's not that. It's actually the fact a lot of people are pissed off that somehow The Hollywood Reporter would go and bring in all these white men talking about issues like, hold on a sec. They would talk about issues like ethnic stereotypes and female roles. Like, somehow people got so pissed off. Like, I got this article from the Cartoon Brew, and like, there are numerous of tweets of people who are so mad about this. A few examples that I can bring up, holy crap, did Trump pick the Animation Roundtable of Ethnic Stereotypes Roundtables too? And then there's another one saying, can't make this up, Animation Roundtable, and all this kind of stuff. Oh yeah, look at all these white guys discussing ethnic stereotypes and how to break the mold of female characters and all that stuff. And a lot of people are just so mad that who's actually talking about this are just a bunch of white dudes. Literally, that's it. And even Seth Rogen actually kind of took a jab on it, and he decided to make fun of it, actually saying, finally, you could see the white male take on ethnic stereotypes and sexism. Proud to break new grounds, you know, just to go and do that as a joke, really. And so that's pretty much the big thing, is that people are just so pissed off over the fact that they only gathered a bunch of middle-aged white men to talk about issues like stereotyping and female role models. Like, that's the whole picture. But here's the big catch. Now, I decided to go and do some research. Now, I decided to do some research and to go and check on the entire roundtable. I decided to go and check it out myself to see how it is, and admittedly, it is actually very insightful, but I do have a very interesting question. Among all those people who actually got mad that a bunch of white dudes are talking about ethnic stereotypes and female role models, how many of them do you think have actually seen it? Like, let's be honest here. Because the thing is, I watched this myself, and probably throughout the entire hour, I would guess maybe 5 minutes was worth looking into that issue. And most of it is not necessarily about the issue itself, but it's more about how they had to make their movie. Because the grand majority was about everybody's experience in making that animated feature film. Like, of course they would have to bring in ethnic stereotypes because Seth Rogen made Sausage Party. And that actually included a lot of stereotypes in order to really, to really bring in the message of unity over religion. And of course they have to talk about, they have to talk a bit about, sexism, and they have to bring in about, crafting a female role model, because many animated films actually, in 2016, actually do feature female leads. Rather it be with Zootopia with Judy Hopps, or There Is Moana, and even with Trolls with, what was it? Princess, I don't freaking care. That movie's not that good anyways. But you get what I mean. There's a lot of female leads in animated features, so that's why the issue was brought up. But it's not necessarily brought up in a big way. Like, it was only worth 5 minutes of it, and most of it has to do with the making of the feature films themselves. So honestly, it really wasn't that worth getting angry over and stuff like that. If anything, the real people to blame, and okay, well, technically a lot of people are expressing their anger, it's actually towards the Hollywood Reporter themselves. It has nothing to do with all the white men that are actually involved. Because the way that they pretty much labeled it, I mean, the first thing that you see would actually make anybody mad. Because, I'm on the Hollywood Reporter so far, and the first thing that you see, you see all the white guys that are on this picture, and then you see the title, which it says, Animation Roundtable, Seth Rogen and 6 more on avoiding ethnic stereotypes and how to break the mold of princesses. Yeah, that is, whoever the fridge made that title, yeah, I'm sorry, dude, honestly, that was stupid. That really was stupid. I don't know what you were thinking in order to sell this. Just make it about the Animation Roundtable. Honestly, I said, it didn't even cover the majority of it. And, holy crap. Like, no wonder the anime, like, no wonder the Hollywood Reporter is actually getting a lot of crap over this, because the way that they're marketing this is just the wrong way to go. Really, like, because people are now making it a lot more about social issues than it is about what's actually been covered in the animation, in this animation roundtable, which is the animated films that they've made. And literally, that's it. That's literally it. I mean, the whole thing is just, honestly, I feel like this is getting a little bit out of hand. It's almost in the same veins of how I feel about when they announced Scarlett Johansson as Motoko in Ghost in the Shell or something like that. It's honestly a little bit ridiculous. But I could definitely tell you why that this is happening. Because here's the thing. I know for a fact that this is not the first time where that they have an animation roundtable like this, that they feature this animation roundtable that would feature, you know, a bunch of white dudes talking about animation. You might be wondering, why is it that people are getting so fired up about this? And I can tell you, it's actually because of the society that we are currently living in with Donald Trump. Yes, it actually has to do with Donald Trump. No, I'm not saying that the tweet that mentioned that Donald Trump had something to do with this roundtable directly. No, it's not really that. Allow me to tell you why is it that Donald Trump really made, like, really heated up society to where anybody can be immediately pissed off over something like this with an animation roundtable where a bunch of white guys would briefly talk about issues like stereotypes and women. Here's the thing. Now, there is no secret, there is no hiding that Donald Trump's campaign throughout the 2016 election is that he really went, like, he really drove everybody's inner hate. Like, that's the big thing that he did. Like he would just go out and he would say some of the nastiest things. Like, some people would even accuse him of having freaking Tourette syndrome, but he doesn't care. Like, he would say the nastiest things about other, like other religious groups, about other racial groups, about women or about whatever, and he wouldn't care. Like, he would just go out and just freaking say it, you know? Like, rather it be with, like, his point of view of Muslims and how he's advertising them like Jews in the, during World War II, or how he claims that, like, all Mexicans are rapists and that they're all illegal immigrants and stuff like that. Or how he simply objectifies women and how he has, like, several cases of sexual harassment and sexual assault. And that he would go, you know, he would just openly claim, oh, like, he could just grab women by the pussy without any care whatsoever. And everybody was so built up upon that. Apparently, there are many of idiotic Americans that actually do have this mentality, or they have this inner hatred. And finally, because of Trump, they feel like now it is actually okay to go out and actually let out this discriminatory hate. This is pretty much why we are seeing nowadays how mainstream media is seriously reporting on, like, this, like people going around with this massive hate and acting so bigoted and so being so discriminatory towards so many different people just because they are legit different, and why we're seeing a rise out of different groups like the KKK suddenly jumping for joy that Trump is president, or that we're seeing, like, the creation of the American neo-Nazi group, which I guess nowadays you have to call them the alt-right. And so far, how many Trump supporters have this mentality of white supremacy. So that's the big thing about Donald Trump, is that he's pretty much promoting white supremacy. Now, it is debatable if Trump himself actually does believe that, but he is trying to advertise to idiots that white supremacy can be a thing. Like, he's just using it to con morons, basically. That's the whole thing. However, at the same time, while Trump is doing it, there are also other people who are against it. And throughout that campaign and throughout Trump's time, there are people out there who are pretty much livid. there are people who are so mad at Trump and they have to put on their activism level up to, like, they cranked that up to 11. And that is why we're seeing a lot more protests, we're seeing a lot more activists, and we're seeing a lot of people going out there to try to stop these deplorables, and they're trying to stop Trump in general. And that's pretty much why we're living in this society today. And this is pretty much why that a lot of people, you know, a lot of these people with this activist mind, sometimes they can go a little bit out of hand. And sometimes their focus can go beyond Trump and they'll see what's happening in the entertainment industry and why they would get mad over some things that happen in there. You know, rather it be the controversy with Scarlett Johansson as, you know, as Motoko in Ghost in the Shell, or that entire controversy of Ghostbusters. I can guarantee you if the 2016 elections didn't happen, then neither would the Ghostbusters controversy either, or even this. And that's pretty much why this is happening, is that people are so, like, because Trump heated so many people up to where they have to put on their activism mode and, like, whatever is viewed as white people taking charge of things that are not in their category, rather it be ethnic stereotypes or women, then they get mad. They immediately jump into action and they just go flat out attack. You know, that's why The Hollywood Reporter is getting so many, you know, is getting so much crap out of it. But honestly, if I could put in a little bit of my piece of what's going on in this situation, I think in the article in Cartoon Brew, I believe Amidamidi actually says it best right here. If I can find that little passage. Yes, right here. It says, at the end of the day, I think the issue is far more nuanced than simply who should and who shouldn't be allowed to tell certain kinds of stories. There's nothing wrong with John Musker and Ron Clements making a film about a culture different than their own. There's nothing wrong with Seth Rogen making an animated film that uses ethnic stereotypes for comedy. The issue really isn't that they're making these kinds of animated films at major American animation studios. The issue is that they're the only people who are allowed to make animated features at these studios. White males have made well over 95% of all animated features in American film history. What rubs people the wrong way is to see how Hollywood animated features are addressing issues of inclusivity, diversity, and tolerance more than ever before, yet the directorial rank remains largely homogenous and resistant to the very themes that the films are exploring. As long as Hollywood says one thing and does another, it'll be hard to view a lot of these films as anything more than cynical corporation cash grab. So really, the issue is a lot bigger than what people think it is. It's not necessarily the Hollywood Reporter that has a problem. It's more how the animation industry is right now and how the grand majority of, you know, how the grand majority of animated films are directed by white men. And that you know, that's pretty much the whole thing. You know, as much as I would love to see, like, women to go out and actually make their own directing animated, to go out to direct animated feature films, or if they can go, or, like, people of color can go and direct animated features films as well. But the thing is that most Hollywood, like, the thing is, how the industry is built, it's mostly white males. So the only thing that I feel like what people have to do is that, you know, honestly, it's not really Hollywood's mindset that you have to go and change their mind. What I want to see is, I probably mentioned this before in the animation podcast, is that I want to see people of color and women to really put up their A game. Show that, like, you people have to go out and show them your worth. You got to be the ones responsible to really improve yourselves as artists and show them that you are capable of directing animated features as well as your white male counterparts. That's what you got to do. Show, like, because the thing is, many companies like Disney, technically, they don't necessarily care who's directing it, really. Like, it could be a man, like, it could be a guy, a woman, a person of color, or whatever. but they want to hire really talented people. And that's what you got to do. You got to really make your self-worth like 1,000 times better than you can ever imagine. You always got to have that need to go and improve. So if you want to see more people of color and more women to be directing animators or like directors of animated films, then those people of color and women have to really build themselves up. Like, don't attack Hollywood. Go help out the people of like all the artists who are people of color and women. Go help them out. Make them greater so that we can see more movies directed by women and people of color. That's the whole big thing. And as for the activists who are really pissed off about this whole situation with the Hollywood Reporter, and for those of them who are really mad that apparently this animation roundtable has a bunch of white guys like going out and talk about issues like ethnic stereotypes and breaking the role for women parts. You know, honestly, in that regard, like, I'm not saying to turn off your activism mode or anything like that. You know, if you're going to go out and try to fight this, if you want to go out and fight for the rights of yourself and others to go and take down Trump and his, like, mentally challenged, deplorable supporters, then go ahead, go do it. I highly encourage that. But the thing is, do your research a little bit, and two, like, don't, you know, honestly, you're not really going to achieve much if you're really gonna go and attack small things like an animation roundtable. Like I said, it's more important that you go and attack Trump than something like an animation roundtable built up by the Hollywood Reporter. Just saying. But, and one more thing I would like to mention, technically, there is a small piece of variety that we do have here. I mean, yes, technically, they are all white male, but technically, Byron Howard is gay. So at least, there is a little bit of a variety, a small piece of diversity. Like, even though, yes, they're all white male, you do have a gay guy involved. So at least, it's something. But anyways, that's pretty much going to be it for this week on the Animation Podcast. So I just want to say thank you guys so much for listening. And you can find more of my work at film-book.com. All you have to do is search for Mathieu Brunet or the Animation Podcast. You can also find more of my work, or you can find me at AnimeF505. If you have listened to this podcast on iTunes or any other podcast service, and do you mind doing us a little favor and rate and review this episode, that would be lovely. And if you have listened to this podcast on YouTube, then hit that like button on our video and leave us a little comment on your thoughts on the news this week. Tune in next week for the latest episode of the Animation Podcast and all things animation. Thank you guys so much for listening, and until next week, see you later, dudes.